Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, September 13th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Today's program is titled America Needs a New Presidency and Bill Clinton is Key. Now, last Wednesday night, just three nights ago, President Obama's speech, you could say, is Exhibit A as to why we must have a new presidency. There were many things wrong with what he said, and we'll dissect them today with our guest, but there's one overriding factor that you should never lose sight of, which is that he openly defied the Constitution in his refusal to come to the Congress to request that the Congress authorize military action. In fact, he said he doesn't have to do that. And in the background briefing before his speech, an administration official said that the authorization to use military force from 2001 is adequate for what he intends to do. On Thursday, then, Lyndon LaRouche told a leading Russian news service that this statement itself, Obama's speech, is an impeachable act. So today we're going to be speaking with Jeffrey Steinberg, who is well known to listeners of the LaRouche Show, readers of the Executive Intelligence Review, people who go to the LaRouche PAC website. Jeff is probably one of the most important intelligence and counterintelligence figures in the world. And I'd like to begin, Jeff, besides welcoming you to the program. How are you?
Good. How you doing, Harley?
Good. Let's begin with Wednesday night's national address. We'll pick up, as we go into it, this question of the shaping of the new presidency and the special role which Bill Clinton can and must play. But I just want to begin with how this Lyndon LaRouche said Obama's speech is another prime example of an impeachable offense. What feedback are you getting from people in Washington after Wednesday night's speech?
Well, let's actually go back to Tuesday. On Tuesday afternoon, Obama met, I'm not sure if it was on Capitol Hill or at the White House, but he met with John Boehner, Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, and Harry Reid, and for the first time laid out to them what his perspective was on conducting this war against the threat represented by the Islamic State jihadist organization. And on Tuesday afternoon, for the first time, those congressional leaders were told that Obama plans to include a $1 billion line item in the continuing resolution to keep the government funded through to the middle of December for the arming and training of the Syrian rebels. Now, this alone caused a good deal of pandemonium because you don't just simply drop it in the course of an informal briefing that you want Congress to pony up and American taxpayers to pony up another $1 billion for the training and arming of a Syrian rebel force that has absolutely failed miserably every step along the way. We give them weapons and training, and suddenly we find that the people who we supposedly vetted have gone over to the side of al-Nusra Front or even ISIS. And so this was the backdrop to the Wednesday night speech that the president gave. Number one, as you correctly said, he made it very clear, as he did the day before, that he has no intention of going to Congress for a new authorization for the use of military force.
Jeff, he's been saying this all along, hasn't he? Because every step, every time he sent more troops in, he says, I'm informing the Congress, but I don't have to.
Precisely. And that is a crime against the Constitution. He should have been impeached back in 2011 when he did the identical thing with the regime change war in Libya, which he tried to disguise as a strictly humanitarian intervention. Then he claimed that the United States was only playing a minor role, that somehow or other wars are exclusively defined by boots on the ground. So he should have been impeached back in 2011. If Congress had the spine to uphold the Constitution, we'd be having a very different discussion today, because this president would have been removed from office already, and we'd be in very different shape as a nation. But so now
at
it's again.
Time, Jeff, at that time, there were people in Congress who were saying he should come before them. But if I remember correctly, it was John Kerry and John McCain who worked out a special deal in the Congress to not have any demands for Obama to come to them.
Well, what happened is that Kerry and McCain drafted their own authorization for the use of military force, introduced it into the Senate. It was on the floor of the full Senate being debated when suddenly Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell got together in the cloakroom and added up the numbers, and they realized that they were about to be defeated. So they pulled that bill and never made any attempt to reintroduce it. In other words, back in 2011, they did not have the votes in the Senate for authorization to go forward with the Libyan operation. So the whole thing was completely illegal, completely unconstitutional, and Obama should have been impeached then. In recent days, Mr. LaRouche has emphasized that we're getting very, very close to the point of Obama being dumped. He got away with it barely in 2011. The consequences of that were seen a year later with the murder of Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other American officials, and with the chaos that has completely engulfed Libya ever since that regime change intervention. So people are not quite as stupid as they sometimes appear to be. And there's at least some recognition that we really shouldn't go through this same thing again. After Obama's speech on Wednesday night, the biggest reaction, which was across the spectrum, there are clearly people in Congress who don't think we should be engaged at all in this, you know, war against the Islamic State. There are others who believe that we should be doing 100 times more than we're doing. But across that spectrum, there's a large number of senators and congressmen who said yesterday that he's got to come to Congress. This is not an if proposition. This is written in the law. Chris Murphy, who's a Democratic senator from Connecticut, said that the Constitution is a very pesky document because it doesn't differentiate between how Congress and the president operate when it's 2 months before an election versus other occasions. It's uniform, it's consistent, and only the Congress has the authority to declare war. And in his speech on Wednesday night, Obama was issuing a series of completely self-contradictory lying statements. On the one hand, he said, no American boots on the ground, no replay of the Afghan or Iraq war. Oh, but by the way, 475 more American soldiers are being sent, presumably with boots in hand, to Iraq to engage in the military operations against the Islamic State. That means that 475 puts the total figure at about 1,500 American boots on the ground. Anybody with an institutional memory of how we began our engagement in Vietnam will recognize that the parallels are crystal clear. It's got to go to Congress. 3 weeks ago, Mr. LaRouche, in one of his Friday evening webcasts, explicitly endorsed the position taken by General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that the U.S. does have to assist in a campaign to wipe out the Islamic State. It poses that kind of threat. And General Dempsey also made it clear in a speech he gave out at the Aspen Institute in late July, and again in a press conference a few weeks back with Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, that you must simultaneously wage military operations in Iraq and in Syria. You've got to hit them from both sides, otherwise they will have a safe haven that they can always retreat to. Now, the implication of that is that you've got to work with the Assad government. You've got to actually coordinate with the Syrian military in the same way that in Iraq we're coordinating with the Iraqi military as well as the Kurdish Peshmerga and even some Shiite militia. So all of this means that we're talking about real war. Obama also kept referring to it as a counterterrorism operation to avoid using the word war, but on other occasions in the same speech, he said that we will be conducting more bombing campaigns. We've already carried out 150 bombing sorties over Iraq, and that American pilots will remain in harm's way, and that this is an open-ended conflict where there's no clear idea of how many months or years it will take to complete the job. So
British Prime Minister Cameron said it's going to be a generational fight. But
right.
What I'd like to do, Jeff, is just because some of what you've covered, I think we have to break down a little bit for the listeners, because there's so much psychological warfare and they're using the beheadings and the fear to manipulate people. So I want to actually take up two questions here that come out of what you were just saying. The first is on the Syria question. Assad has been fighting these terrorists. Obama says Assad was helping the terrorists by fighting the so-called moderates. And now the open-ended side of an attack on Syria could well include attacks on Assad as well as the so-called Islamic State. So I'd like you to take up this question of the Syria side. I believe it was Pat Lang who said Obama is going to be fighting two simultaneous wars in Syria against ISIS and against Assad. So I'd like your comments on that.
Right. Well, look, if you're going to be fighting that kind of two simultaneous wars, then it's absolutely doomed to failure. And you've got to just simply make a clear-cut decision, which is that you've got to work with what you have available. The various non-ISIS rebel organizations have no capacity to defeat the Islamic State, none whatsoever. One of the leading organizations within this so-called Islamic Front, which is the so-called more moderate Islamic fighters, financed and created by the Saudis, just had one of their underground bunkers blown up where their top 12 commanders were all meeting. All 12 of them were killed, and it's unclear what the source of that attack was. But the point is that there is no credible rebel opposition, and therefore either you work with the Syrian army and therefore with the Assad government, or you're kidding yourself if you think you're going to carry out a competent operation against the Islamic State inside Syria. By the way, they control 35% approximately of Syrian territory, largely in the north of the country and on the eastern segment, which borders on Iraq. And therefore, they have contiguous territory. And if you're not conducting a serious and competent operation to squeeze them from both the Syrian and Iraqi sides, you're going to get a situation like we've already seen in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where Taliban was able to cross the border into Pakistan and enjoy safe havens in the tribal areas, and therefore they've not been stymied in the least. So,
Jeff, are there some in the intelligence and military community who are saying we should reach an accommodation with Assad, or at least a coordinated action with Assad to defeat the Islamic State first?
Yes, there are, and several things on that. I mean, Richard Haass, former senior State Department official who's now president of the New York Council on Foreign Relations, had an article a week ago, I forget what publication it was in, but he said explicitly, there are no other options. You have to work with Assad. Otherwise, forget it. You're never going to defeat ISIS. So there's that view. There are news reports, which I've independently confirmed from U.S. government sources, that basically we already are cooperating with Assad insofar as we're using Germany, we're using Russia, we're using Iraq cutouts to provide actionable intelligence to the Syrian military where there's opportunities for them to really deliver some significant blows to the Islamic State networks inside Syria. So it's being done on a quasi-covert basis, but that's not the way to operate. The special UN envoy on Syria was just in Damascus meeting with Assad, and as I understand it, there is an effort coming through Ban Ki-moon and the UN to resume the political negotiations that failed at Geneva 1 and Geneva 2, but to try to revive them, given the fact that the circumstances are quite different given the expansion of the Islamic State's operations inside Syria, and that there may be a grounds for reaching the kind of political agreement that would open up for a much more effective military operation on the Syrian side against the Islamic State.
Now, Jeff, I think the other point that shows the absolutely non-serious aspect of the Obama so-called strategy is the first place that he sent John Kerry to coordinate the effort was Saudi Arabia. That there's a continuing cover-up of the Saudi role in supporting jihadists in Syria as well as around the world. The 28 Pages comes into this. So I think this is, I'd like you to comment on that, because this is obviously one of the other examples of just the fraud of the whole Obama policy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, the dam is bursting on the 28 Pages, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people who took very careful note and were not at all pleased at the idea that the president sent Kerry to Saudi Arabia on September 11th. I mean, 13th anniversary of the attacks. And what's happened in the last several weeks is that you're getting a real groundswell of national media attention to the 28 pages and to Obama's refusal to release them. What this included is a major segment on CNN at the beginning of this last week, a lengthy article in New Yorker magazine, a lengthy piece yesterday in Al Jazeera, and last night a 15-minute news segment on public television on the NewsHour. So this is really breaking significant new ground. Senator Bob Graham, retired, has given two lengthy interviews to TV stations down in the Sarasota, Florida area. So I think that the pressure is building. After the CNN broadcast on Monday, which the White House had refused to participate in, the White House called back CNN and basically said that they had referred the letter from the 9/11 families demanding the release of the 28 pages to the office of the Director of National Intelligence, General James Clapper, for review. So in other words, here's a president who on at least two known occasions was seated eyeball to eyeball in the same room with family members of those killed in 9/11, and he delivered a solemn promise to declassify the 28 pages. We're now 5.5 years into his presidency. He hasn't done it. In fact, the Obama administration went in the opposite direction. The Solicitor General went to federal court in support of the Saudis and claimed that they had sovereign immunity from any civil lawsuits on 9/11 or any other support for terrorism. On Thursday, yesterday, the Senate Judiciary Committee, on a unanimous vote, passed the Justice Against Supporters of Terrorism Act, JASTA, out of committee to the full floor of the Senate. Chuck Schumer, Pat Leahy, these were major sponsors of this bill, which basically explicitly allows for civil litigation and other actions against governments and organizations that are shown to have been sources of funding and other support for terrorist organizations. So the momentum
Jeff,
is there.
On the 28 pages, I think also the press conference this last week with Walter
Absolutely,
Jones, Massey,
yes.
and Lynch, and then the fact that the family, the organization of family members of the 9/11 victims stood there with the three congressmen. I think we're seeing more congressmen sign on to that House resolution, aren't we?
Yeah, there's I think something like 16 signatories now, two new signatories yesterday, Jim McGovern and Congressman Sanford from South Carolina, former governor. So yeah, it's building, and I think the public outcry, the media attention, is a significant break in the situation. The administration's under excruciating pressure. It's been out repeatedly in the major media that the Saudis are a major, if not the major, sponsor of the Islamic State terrorist network. They've created a Frankenstein monster, and it's now coming back to potentially haunt them. So they're in a very vulnerable position, and so they're coming under a certain amount of pressure. But the idea that we're going to somehow or other set up the training camps in Saudi Arabia to train the vetted networks of anti-Assad rebels who are going to simultaneously fight against Assad and fight against the Islamic State, this is a level of incompetence that's almost beyond belief. It can't work. You can't do it without cooperation with Syria. We're even cooperating with Iran inside Iraq. So this is one of these instances where, because President Obama 3 years ago announced that Assad has to go and will go, that you're stuck in a situation that is thoroughly untenable.
Well, you're listening to Jeffrey Steinberg. This is the LaRouche Show, Saturday, September 13th, 2014. We're discussing in particular the speech this last week of President Obama, where he attempted, using the best Bush-Cheney rhetoric, to rally a fearful American public to sponsor really an insane strategy. Now, Jeff, I'd like to just, as we go at this question of the fraud of the presidency and the need for a new presidency, just pick up the other strategic major danger, which seems to be largely because of Putin and Poroshenko and the collapse of Ukraine, moving a little bit away from the immediate confrontation, although the NATO summit last week, Cameron and Obama continued to press for deployment of forces on the border with Russia. So where do things stand now with Ukraine? And on that, I just want to mention that We're hearing almost nothing about the MH17 flight, just as we hear almost nothing about the evidence that shows that it was the rebels that we were supporting in Syria that used sarin gas. So these so-called slam dunks for U.S. Initiatives, once again, they're air balls. But anyway, on Ukraine, what's the situation there now?
Well, it's very, very fragile. The assessments from some of our friends in Russia is that while the ceasefire is holding, it's really not clear that Poroshenko and the Ukrainian government is committed to it. Remember that beginning on August 23rd, the rebels in the east of Ukraine launched a very successful counteroffensive, and they were on the verge of an absolute victory over the Ukrainian armed forces in the east of the country. In fact, there were something like 7,000 Ukrainian soldiers in various areas around the east, completely encircled and trapped. So there was a certain reality that a ceasefire was a far better option than an absolute military defeat. So it's iffy whether or not the Ukrainians are regrouping in preparation for a new, you know, attempt once again post-NATO summit to crush the pro-Russian elements in the east, or whether we're genuinely in a trajectory towards a political solution. By the agreements that were reached as part of the Minsk ceasefire, the Ukrainian government is obligated to come up with some kind of law for a devolution of power, greater regional autonomy, and things like that. But there's no indication that the draft laws that they're coming up with come anywhere close to the degree of legitimate autonomy that those areas are demanding. So that aspect of it remains uncertain, and the ceasefire is extremely fragile. Secondly,
in the meantime, the sanctions are being expanded and the NATO forces are being upgraded.
That's right. I think a lot of people look at the upgrading of the NATO forces as somewhat of a joke. You know, a 4,000-person rapid reaction strike force to wage combat against the Russians is not serious, which is why the real danger is that if you get into a conflict in that area, that the likelihood of one side, particularly the NATO side, resorting to nuclear weapons is very great. So, yes, new sanctions were announced and put into immediate operation this morning by the European Union, targeting Russian state banks, targeting the energy sector, and targeting a wide range of technologies that are generally referred to as dual use. In other words, they have both civilian and military possible applications. The net effect of this has been to basically harden the lines of conflict, and it's causing immense damage to the already deeply fragile economies of Western Europe. Big companies in Germany like Siemens, as well as the thousands of critical Mittelstand high-tech companies in Germany are losing a good deal of their business because their business was with Russia and with other countries allied with Russia in the Eurasian Economic Community. So this is a disastrous policy. The British are exploring and exploiting the emergence of a new Cold War. It has a lot to do with the internal politics of Europe, with the British trying to basically bully Germany and France and Italy, who were opposed to this sanctions war against Russia. But in the meantime, two other things happened this week. Number one, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is meeting today, which is Russia, China, the countries of Central Asia, India, and Pakistan will be given full membership next year, Iran is seeking membership. And so you've got Russia moving into a new alliance system among sovereign countries that are outside the framework of this U.S., Europe, Japan sanctions policy. So the Russians are moving in that direction. Also this week, President Putin announced the major restructuring of the defense sector, creating basically a commission to oversee a major expansion of Russian defense production, which he will be personally chairing and overseeing, with Dmitry Rogozin, one of the deputy prime ministers, as his deputy chairman of this commission. They intend to spend $600 billion equivalent over the next 10 years on a major expansion of their military capabilities. That's a doubling of their military expenditures. It's still a fraction per year of what the U.S. spends, but nevertheless, they're focusing on their strategic forces. So the war danger has not abated, and in fact, Mr. LaRouche has emphasized that it won't end until Obama is removed from office. The policy is coming from the British, but the British have no credibility if they don't have the United States muscle, military muscle behind it.
Well, that just, and that comes to the topic of the program, the need for a new presidency. On the one hand, you have Obama as a British puppet creating the circumstances where we could at any moment be plunged into a thermonuclear confrontation. We're not even going to touch on the economy much today, but I can tell you from a series of conferences I've attended in Europe, the line is the U.S. economy is relatively better shaped than Europe. And then when you push them on that, they say, well, the European economies are virtually gone, and we realize the U.S. economy is on the edge also. But then on the other side, you have the potential that exists with the BRICS, with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which will not be responded to in any positive way by Obama. So give us a sense of what Mr. LaRouche has been talking about as to his approach to this, the idea that we need to pull together the few people in this country who have a capability, who have a serious standing in the world who could do this, to form a new presidency.
Well, start with the fact that Obama has to be removed from office this year. All of the conditions are ripe for his impeachment. There was a column that appeared yesterday by a prominent pollster, which basically said that all of the polling data indicates that barring a major shakeup in the situation, the Republicans, with all of their problems, are poised to potentially take control over the Senate while retaining control over the House, and that this would be a catastrophic situation for the country and obviously for the Democratic Party. Therefore, it is in the key interest of the Democratic Party to take the lead in removing Obama from office. I had a discussion with a current government official last week who said that, you know, just as a group of Republicans went to Nixon and told him it was time for him to pack up by resignation, there's a group of leading Democrats who ought to be assembled to go to the White House to say the same thing to Obama. Once that happens, and, you know, assuming it were to take place this year, but whenever this presidency is ended, you've got to regroup around a new presidency in the image of what we had in this country under Franklin Roosevelt, under John Kennedy. And, you know, the closest thing that we had to that kind of competent and functioning leadership at the executive branch was under Bill Clinton. Clinton was no JFK or no FDR, but he is a smart, intelligent, big idea thinker, who was an effective and competent president. He's the only one that we've got around, and therefore he is the pivotal player with the experience of 8 years as president, with having worked across the aisle to assemble a leadership team for a new presidency. Now, the Constitution bars Bill Clinton from being running for office or from serving as president for a third time. But that's fine. He can play the role of a kind of a senior statesman shaping the next presidency around a competent candidate and an assembled team of people capable of implementing a major policy change. And
Jeff, on this, I'd like you to go through a little bit what most people don't know. Even, you know, people who read our publications closely know this, but most people don't know of the significance of the developments in 1997-98 when Clinton was president. And we went through a series of economic shocks. The Asia crisis, which was provoked by Soros and speculators, which collapsed a number of the countries in South Asia. And then the long-term capital management collapse based on a Russian bond default. And at that point, when you needed a president to step forward, Clinton appeared to be moving in that direction very closely along the lines identified by Lyndon LaRouche. And I'd like you to just give people a sense of that, because that is the kind of crisis where you do need leadership, and Clinton did step up in that situation.
Sure. Well, look, I think, go back, 1997, Mr. LaRouche launched a concerted international campaign for a reinstatement, a new Bretton Woods system, a reinstatement of the global system of fixed exchange rates, because it was already clear at that point that you had a massive short-term capital flow that was a form of piracy. Vulture funds, hedge funds, would pool their money and move in and quickly move out of national currencies, national economies, under globalization, so that this predatory globalization phenomenon was destroying, in some cases, Malaysia was a good example. It took decades for Malaysia to come up from poverty, to become a growing and modern and effective nation state, particularly under Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. And Soros and company carried out a vicious piracy assault against the Malaysian currency, against the stock markets, and created an absolute crisis. Clinton, as president, came to understand that these short-term volatile capital flows represented a serious crisis that was going to only get worse. In a speech that he delivered in the fall of 1998, September 1998, at the New York Council on Foreign Relations, which is really the heart of the Wall Street beast.
Going to the lion's den.
Right. Clinton announced that his intention was to launch a reform of the international financial and monetary system. And very clearly people understood that the direction that he was going in very much was in sync with LaRouche's call for a new Bretton Woods. In fact, there was a group of 22 project launched by Clinton involving participation of 22 governments, both advanced sector and developing sector, to take on this question of a new global financial architecture, which was the term that Clinton used. And that work was moving forward. It was actually quite robust. And it was in that context that the impeachment campaign, the Lewinsky affair and what followed from that, was launched in order to finish off the Clinton presidency. It was widely known that he was not going to be impeached by the Senate. But nevertheless, the disruption and the media attacks and everything else, what Hillary Clinton then called the vast right-wing conspiracy, was aimed at preventing this kind of initiative to reform the global financial system. This was
Jeff,
a London Wall Street.
Things,
yeah, go ahead.
One of the important things from the September 1998 speech is where he said, "We're in the worst shape globally since the end of the war." And he specifically said that the approach of the International Monetary Fund has not worked. And so it was very explicitly parallel to what Lyndon LaRouche was saying with the New Bretton Woods.
Exactly. And it was known that there was a very robust policy dialogue between President Clinton and Lyndon LaRouche ongoing at that time. And so this was a further factor that led London and Wall Street to conclude that they had to bring about the end of the Clinton presidency. Now, in the midst of that, you had Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who's now the senior economic columnist for the Daily Telegraph, was in the United States and was literally the case officer for all of these extreme right-wing Patriot Party kind of crazy networks that were part of the whole mobilization against President Clinton. You had a major Israeli intelligence factor involved in the attack. In other words, everybody who represented an asset of the London Wall Street financial oligarchy was set off to go after President Clinton. And if they couldn't remove him from office, if they couldn't get away with killing him, then they were committed to killing off his presidency. And so, in fact, that is exactly what happened, to the point that a year later in 1999, Clinton made the biggest mistake of his presidency by not holding out his signature on the bill that repealed Glass-Steagall and Graham Leach Bliley. Now, the Wall Street had done such a monumental job of buying off Congress on that issue that the vote to repeal Glass-Steagall was cast by a veto-proof majority. But had the president gone to the wall, he could have prevented it. But by that point, his presidency had been largely destroyed already. So Clinton is familiar with these issues, unquestionably.
And I think the other thing that's important here is that we're talking about a situation which is now much more extreme in terms of the danger of a global systemic financial collapse and economic collapse, and also a World War III danger, so that you need someone who's not getting on-the-job training but actually can come in and do something. Now, this obviously, the first thing that should be done after Obama's impeached is to go ahead with LaRouche's four laws, starting with Glass-Steagall. Do you have any update on the momentum around the Glass-Steagall legislation in the U.S. Congress? Is there anything moving with that?
Well, there is a certain amount of continuing movement on it. I think that in a discussion with colleagues last Sunday, Mr. LaRouche was brutally frank. He's looking at the kind of political correlation of forces and the kind of radical shock to the system that is required to really get the job done, to realign the United States with the developments that we're seeing from the BRICS countries, from China's science initiatives, the collaboration of China and Russia. These are countries that are reasserting the authority of the sovereign nation state and are actually acting on one of the core principles of American foreign policy, dating back to Secretary of State, later President John Quincy Adams, which is the idea that you look for areas of collaboration among perfectly sovereign nation states. So LaRouche's point was very clear. There are not a lot of options available to the United States other than creating a new presidency in which Bill Clinton is the central organizer, the central figure shaping and framing that new presidency. That presumes that Clinton will have fully learned the lessons of the mistakes he made as president, and will see this as a great opportunity for the country, for the world, and even for himself to correct those mistakes. So LaRouche's four principles, cardinal laws of what's required to bring the United States economy back into a state of recovery and growth again, and to lead the world in that regard, those things are going to require the kind of political realignment, the creation of a new presidency that can only be done if Bill Clinton plays the kind of role that LaRouche has prescribed. So it's not as if Congress on its own or in itself is going to do the job. There's 435 members of the House, 100 members of the Senate, and you need a presidency that functions. There are careful limits that the framers of our Constitution placed on presidential authority to avoid tyranny. And we've had the erosion of those restrictions by Bush, Cheney, and now by Obama for the last 13 and a half years. But nevertheless, the fact is that there is a critical role for a strong and constitutionally sound presidency. And that's the only way that the United States is going to survive and avoid a total collapse and disintegration. So the Bill Clinton issue, the presidency issue, is here and now. It's an issue for 2014, not 2016, 2017. It's an immediate crisis, and LaRouche's cold assessment is that unless we get Bill Clinton in the position to frame a new presidency in a timely fashion, then this country may very well be living on borrowed time.
Now, Jeff, since most of our listeners are not going to be able to speak with Bill Clinton about this, what should they do? This is the question I get from a lot of people. Okay, so LaRouche has his channels. LaRouche is working on this. What do I do? So obviously the fight is to win support for, first of all, the impeachment, which I think most people support, but they just don't, they're just fearful and don't think anyone will move on it. But how do we get these four principles established as with the momentum needed to push forward this new presidency?
People have to, first of all, start by understanding what those four cardinal laws are. And, you know, that is a challenge. You know, in these four principles, Mr. LaRouche has essentially restated the core concepts behind what was historically known as the American system, starting with a return to Glass-Steagall. Of course, the founders created a system of commercial banking under a national bank that was consistent with what Roosevelt did with Glass-Steagall. But we've got to go back to sound commercial banking under a national banking system. We have to direct credit at high capital intensive real expansion, which will create tens of millions of high capital intensive, high technology, productive jobs in the economy. And we've got to work as part of an international concerted effort to achieve commercial thermonuclear fusion as the energy source of the future, because it represents a science driver that will open up new domains of science. The Chinese have taken the lead in the project to establish an industrial capacity on the surface of the moon to mine helium-3, which is the fuel, the optimal fuel, for these thermonuclear fusion power plants. So the U.S. has to get back in on policies that other nations have adopted from the American system. So, but again, I think that all of these things, what people need to do is put excruciating pressure on their elected representatives to get this Obama character impeached and out of office. And that's a job overwhelmingly for the Democrats, not the Republicans. It's the Democrats.
The other thing people can count on is that even though he just turned 92 years old this last week, Lyndon LaRouche is on the job, and that his credibility is indicated by the repeated interviews he's doing in Russian media, the spectacular trip by his wife, Helga Zepp LaRouche, the Silk Road lady, to China, that Lynn is at the center of these things, and that people are really... What's necessary is to recruit people to back Lyndon LaRouche because he knows what to do. And I think that's what a lot of our supporters are missing.
Yeah, I think that you're going to hear Helga LaRouche is now back from her two and a half, three-week trip to China. It was an extraordinary success. Part of it was a fact-finding trip. She spoke at two conferences, both on the New Silk Road, one in at a university in north central China, one in Beijing. She got to tour around and see parts of the country she hadn't seen ever, perhaps. And then she spent over a week doing a series of meetings and interviews in Beijing, in the capital. So she has an extraordinary report to bring back. And I think it's a report that will show that ideas that were launched by Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche back in the late 1980s and 90s have been adopted by leading governments of the world. And they are moving forward, not just in words, but in deeds, in implementing these policies. The Eurasian land bridge, first and foremost, under the title The New Silk Road, the Eurasian land bridge is one of the core policies of the new Xi Jinping government in China. There's factions in Russia that want to align with those initiatives. You have the BRICS countries. All of them are taking actions that, in a very fundamental way, are based on principles that were developed by the United States in its early decades. The foreign policy of Quincy Adams, the principle of national banking of Alexander Hamilton. These ideas, the development of infrastructure as a platform for a modern and growing economy. All of these things were developed and first demonstrated here in the United States during the first 100 years of our republic. And the rest of the world is adopting those ideas. At least half the population of the world, represented by the BRICS countries, is going in that direction. And it's not only fitting and appropriate, but it's absolutely strategically vital that the United States comes in on that arrangement and realigns.
And that means that Americans recapture our tradition.
Exactly. So I think that those principles have to be grasped. When people understand the big picture and have a sense of where we are, what historic moment we have reached, and can reach back into the profound history of our republic to understand what to do, to think creatively, to develop tactical initiatives. Once people have got that big picture, they will be 1,000 times more effective and will undoubtedly be a driving force to bringing about exactly the new presidency that LaRouche is calling for and that Bill Clinton's got to play a pivotal role in shaping.
And I think for our listeners, one of the two keys are that between the LaRouche PAC website and the Executive Intelligence Review, you have all the material you need to prepare yourself to be part of this new presidency. The upgrading of executive intelligence review in the last year has been quite significant. There's now a daily executive intelligence review alert that's available. And so there's no excuse for people not being up to the standards that are needed. Now, Jeff, we just have a couple of minutes left. I just wanted to take this opportunity to get your take on what I think is quite an interesting, ironic situation, which is what's happening this next week with the vote in Scotland. Whether or not the separation vote actually passes, it's clear that this is fundamentally shaking the British Empire. Do you have some thoughts on this?
Look, this has profound implications, and one of the things it could very well do is be the trigger for the blowout of the whole transatlantic financial system that you mentioned earlier in the show. We haven't focused a lot of attention on that, but the situation among the major European banks is so fragile that one significant jolt, like full Scottish independence from the British, could be the trigger. Already, two of the biggest banks that operate in Scotland, Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds, have announced that if the referendum passes and Scotland does effectively secede from the United Kingdom, that those banks are going to pull out. Even this past week, when one poll came out showing that the yes vote for secession and separation was in the lead, you had a collapse of the pound sterling. You had all kinds of other turmoil throughout Europe. Yesterday, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who I mentioned earlier, who was basically the MI6 case officer on the campaign by the British to bring down the Clinton presidency, wrote an hysterical article in which he said that if Scotland goes its own separate way, this will lead to a rash of secessionist movements throughout Europe. Catalan, the Basque region, South Tyrol, all of these things. And that basically what this will mean is that there'll be only one last remaining anchor of stability in all of Europe, and that will be Germany. So, you know, he said we're facing a Teutonic Europe if the Scottish vote goes forward as a yes. So, I mean, the level of hysteria is profound. And by the way, you know, Cameron has promised a referendum on whether Britain would leave the European Union altogether, which is supposed to happen sometime in the next year. So you've got a major shakeup of the whole British imperial structure. And they still retain an enormous amount of power through the private system of oligarchical central bank financing, anchored in the Bank of England, the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan. That system is the British system. And so the City of London remains the financial capital of that oligarchical system. That's what's got to be brought to an end. And so implicit in this Scottish separation vote is a real shakeup of the entire financial system because of the central role of the City of London in the British monarchy in retaining control over a system that's already dying and, you know, assured of death sometimes very soon.
And I think the doddering Queen is not amused by this. I thought Cameron's statement the other day showed how hysterical they are, where he said that Scotland, if it breaks with the United Kingdom, will become more vulnerable to terrorism. And of course, I'm sure the people who are favoring separation are well aware of the role of the City of London as Londonistan, as a center, coordinating center, financial center for global terrorism with their Saudi partners.
Right. It was a threat of asymmetric warfare. MI5 and MI6 are herding every Scot that they can find who's committed to retaining union and are paying to fly them or sail them back into Scotland for next Thursday's vote. So this is a historic, really a monumental development, which we'll be obviously deeply interested in the results.
Well, Jeff, we're just about out of time. I want to thank you because I think this was a necessary report for people to get, including because of all the psychological warfare on the Clinton question, for people to get an assessment of what it's going to take for us to turn the situation around. And I think Lynn's point, this is the only option. It's not the best among many options, but it's the only option, is really crucial. So, Jeff, thanks very much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Harley. See you soon, I hope.
Okay, and so this is the brings to an end our program for today, September 13th, 2014. And we'll be back next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern, with the next edition of The LaRouche Show. Thank you.